complete with rose petals floating in the oversized jacuzzi tubs, screamed romance. The kitchen were every cook's dream. The studies, with their leather smell and solid wood paneling, made anyone who had ever read a book visualize curling up in a large armchair in front of the fireplace. Nothing was left to chance. Every smell, every piece of furniture, and certainly the design of the floor plans made these model homes world class. I had the privilege of selling custom homes in my early 20s, using these models as a sales tool. Our offices and welcome center were built out very nicely in what would normally have been a garage. The welcome center opened to a parking lot with manicured landscaping. Yes, you could smell the money and the prestige. It was a hot August day, which was great for business. There were three of us selling that day, Jess, Roy, and me. All three of us worked only on these homes, no outside sales, so we rotated the leads as people visited the models. When a car pulled up, the dance began. We learned not only to make judgment calls based on the car they were driving, but to look for other hints of wealth as well. Certainly, we looked at the lady's hand to see the size of the rock, looked at everyone's feet to see how nice the shoes were, noticed the condition of the manicure, and of course, noticed how expensive the haircut was. We were selling expensive homes, so we were looking for money. That hot August day, I noticed my next lead was driving a new Crown Victoria with no hubcaps. Weird. New car, but your grandmother's car, and no hubcaps or wheel covers. It made no sense. I watched through the window as Chris got out. Chris had a full shaggy beard and wore a white t-shirt with blue jeans that had holes in them before we started paying extra for that, and flip-flops on his feet. His hair hadn't been combed in a while, and I quickly decided that he was just visiting to see how the other half lived, and my new lead was a waste. Oh, well, on to the next one. He was a pleasant guy in a hippie kind of way, and I signed him in and pointed to the models, telling him to make himself at home. I went back to work, but if this had been a real buyer, I would have walked him through the models, demonstrating all of our unique and cool features. In a few minutes, I looked up, and Chris was standing quietly beside my desk asking for a brochure. I have to admit that while I was nice to him, in my mind, I was a total 22-year-old snob. I thought to my arrogant self that he should head back to his double-wide trailer so I could get my work done. Our weekend days were by far our busiest, and we might have three or four potential clients in the models at once. Those were the important days to those of us selling, because those were the days we laid claim to a prospect, making them ours from then on. In the middle of one of our busiest Sundays, Chris showed up again. Only this time, his wife and five small kids piled out of the Ford with no hubcaps. This time, I really was busy, so I ignored them completely. After about half an hour, there was a lull in the crowd, and I noticed the Ford still sitting there, and Chris's wife appeared to sweetly ask some questions about the kitchen, which I answered without so much as offering to walk up and show it to her. What a snot I was. Another hour went by, and I was in deep conversation with a lady who had diamonds the size of headlights in her ears, when here comes hippie Chris again with another question. I finished with Diamond Lady, and Chris asked how much the third model, a big two-story, would be if we were to put a basement under it. I was starting to worry about this poor guy, so I thought I would help him out by explaining how he couldn't afford the home. I explained to him how many thousands of dollars a month that house would be. Chris got a weird look on his face and asked me if it was okay if he paid cash. Cash? Are you kidding me? So Chris and I instantly became best friends. It turns out that he had written some software for the main operations of a startup company that had just gone public, making him a cash multi-millionaire with his stock options. So with Chris and his sweet wife, I made the largest sale I ever made while working there. The only consolation I had in my arrogant stupidity was that they really were moving from a trailer. At least I was right about that. Selling and selling properly matters. Selling and selling properly is not only essential to business, but it is also part of life. Henry Ford said, "Nothing happens until someone sells something." Ultimately, everyone is in sales. All leaders must learn to sell. Selling is part of human interaction. Teachers sell and persuade their students to learn. Parents sell their daughters on who to date. Spouses sell each other on where to go eat. And in business, money is made by selling. No money is made unless and until a sale is made. The first thing that will come to mind for most of you is that you don't want to be in sales. Most people view sales from the outside and sometimes from the inside as a manipulative, pushy process. When done properly, sales should never be manipulative, and it should never be pushy. Buying from a great salesperson who is a professional is actually a very pleasurable event, much like having a world-class waiter serve you in a restaurant. By the way, the waiter is making a sale as well. When done right, selling is an honorable and noble profession. It is right for your doctor to sell you on taking care of yourself, and for your pastor to sell you on the value of a rich spiritual life. Understanding the steps a buyer goes through and assisting them in the process does not cheapen sales as a profession. It is unwise to lump an entire profession under a stereotype just because some don't practice their craft with care. There are a lot of funny lawyer jokes, and in our culture, we have a certain view of attorneys. However, a really high-quality attorney is actually a joy to work with. Just because some folks don't practice law with class doesn't mean the practice of law isn't noble. Selling is one of the highest paid professions. In most organizations, the top salespeople are some of the best paid, and it is not unusual for them to make even more than their boss. I have several salespeople in our company who make more than vice presidents. Most companies have the good sense not to put a glass ceiling on a huge revenue generator like a great salesperson. Because leading involves persuading the team to follow you in a certain direction, people who know how to sell often end up leading. One of the tracks that most often leads to CEO is through the sales and marketing area of the company. Rainmakers, people who create large amounts of revenue, are always noticed and considered as a leadership team grows. The steps. Everyone who buys anything, from an idea to a product to a service, goes through four steps to make the buy. Everyone who sells walks through four steps with the buyer. There are no exceptions. Your product or situation is no different. Everyone, every time, does all four steps. The more money is involved in the transaction, the more pronounced the steps. The more important the transaction, the more pronounced the steps. The more time involved in the purchase, the more pronounced the steps. The four steps are: 1, qualification; 2, rapport; 3, education and information; 4, close. If you ignore the steps and or try to skip one and or do them out of order, you will get a backlash. Your buyer will not like you, and you will feel pushy because you likely are. Any situation that involves successful persuasion is going to flow through these steps intentionally, definitely, and with class. If you prepare your approach to persuading people this way, you will see much success. Qualification. Qualifying buyers is the most overlooked and ignored step in the buying process. You will waste time, money, and energy trying to sell to an unqualified prospect. You waste time because they aren't going to buy. You waste money because your marketing budget is drained aiming at the wrong target. You also waste money because your wasted time could have been better used to actually make a sale to a qualified buyer. Finally, you waste energy because it is very draining on you and your prospect to be discussing something that is never going to happen. First, a qualified prospect has the money. A qualified prospect has the money or can get the money to make the purchase. Not everyone has the money, but on smaller purchases, most do. It is just a matter of their prioritizing their money. Even people who appear to be flat broke seem to find $1,000 or so to purchase the services of a bankruptcy attorney. When we want something badly enough on smaller purchases, we find the money. So just because someone says they don't have the money does not mean that is correct. That statement can mean some of the following steps haven't been applied to the sale correctly. Second, a qualified prospect has the time. in our frenetic culture of go, 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 we might very well have the money, but not the time to engage in a purchase. There are lots of things that fit in my budget, but I simply don't have the time. You can give me a free vacation on a cruise ship, which would be nice of you, but it is likely that I am booked to speak on leadership, be on my radio show, or something else, and would have to turn down your nice gift. If you work for a company, most of the time you can't just leave work in the middle of the day. So a great deal on something that requires you to leave work won't be purchased by you, no matter how cheap or exciting it is. You simply don't have the time. Third, a qualified prospect has the need or the want. A qualified prospect has the need or the want. Few of us in America have basic needs that aren't met. We often say we need something that is simply a want. However, simply wanting something is one of the things that makes you a qualified prospect. There is a saying among real estate agents that if someone wants to look at a home in a snowstorm, they are really motivated to make it happen. To go out in a snowstorm to look at a home says that you really have a pressing need or you just love snow. The very act of asking to look at a home in a snowstorm goes a long way toward qualifying you. That is a lot different than driving around on a beautiful Sunday afternoon and noticing an open house, so you walk through, kill some time, and check out your neighbor's decorating. Orville Ray Wilson says, customers buy for their reasons, not yours. And fourth, a qualified prospect has the power. A qualified prospect has the power to make the decision. Many salespeople make a huge mistake and assume the CEO has the power to make all decisions. I don't have the power to purchase computers for my company that I 100% own. Why? Because I have given that power to my IT team since I am a computer idiot. The power was delegated. If you are in the diamond business, you are wasting your time talking to me about a diamond purchase. I don't wear diamonds. My wife does. I've been married 30 years, and I am way too smart to make a huge rock purchase without the real decision maker there. I have the money, but I don't have the power to make the decision. So I am not a qualified buyer. When you try to sell someone who does not have the power to purchase, you quickly become a high-pressure salesperson, and no one will want to do business with you. Remember that everyone is in sales. Look at problem areas in your business or business model to see if you are trying to make a sale to an unqualified person. You might be surprised how much the concept of properly qualifying a prospect can apply to. When a young lady puts on her Facebook page that she is in a relationship, it says to the guy admiring her picture that she is not a qualified prospect. The concept of properly qualifying a prospect by making sure they have the money, time, need or want, and power to buy from you is far-reaching and not just limited to a straight commission salesman. You should even look at your overall marketing plan through the lens of qualifying the prospect. Sometimes we call that knowing your target market. You wouldn't want to target an unqualified market. Building rapport. The second step of the buying-selling process is to build rapport. Building rapport gives the buyer a chance to trust you, your company, your idea, and or your product. When seeking trust, we all know that you have only one chance to make a first impression. In most cases, in a sales situation, rapport is built by you personally. You have about 1 minute to find common ground with a buyer to establish friendly conversation where they begin to trust you. This is not a manipulative kind of thing, but something we all do when meeting a stranger. We size up the stranger to see if we can trust them. Teach your kids to look people in the eye and have a firm handshake. When you go for a job interview, wear a belt, unless you're applying with a rep group. Make sure your breath doesn't stink. All these things help build rapport. You can spend thousands of dollars on TV and Yellow Page ads for your plumbing company and still fail by sending a nasty character with no manners to knock on my front door for my wife to let into our home. To top it off, he was 30 minutes late. Even if you give your service away for free, my wife won't use your company after that. Be 5 minutes early in a neat pressed uniform, complete with little blue boot covers and a pleasant attitude, and you will have a customer for life. You can even charge more if you build rapport like that. Networking. In addition to building rapport, you can and should attempt to find common ground in two other ways. One is networking. You have instant rapport and common ground if a trusted person sent you. If you are sent to me through a close friend, you might actually get past my personal assistant for an appointment. If you come to me off the street, you will be served by someone else in our company. If you want to build rapport with decision makers, you should always be looking for referrals. I'm not talking about some artificial referrals gathered by a door-to-door salesperson where you give them your friends' names, wishing the entire time you hadn't. I'm talking about real connections of credibility due to you loving your experience with our company. We have all told a friend about a great movie or a great book that they simply must read. That is a genuine referral. The trick in our business is to create such quality that we go viral with positive referrals in the community and on the internet, creating instant rapport. And we must be very intentional about pushing referrals into the market as part of our sales plan. That can be as simple as asking for referrals. Hey, I'm just finishing up a custom home building job for a very happy customer, so I have an open slot. Do you know of anyone thinking of building a home you could introduce me to? Almost no custom home builder ever asks that question. Yet after building a home a couple of years ago, I have helped sell many home building jobs for my builder, who was awesome. And I didn't get a commission. I was just spreading the word as a happy customer. Ask for referrals. Do your research. Your best lead is a warm lead where a referral sent you. Once you have that connection, you should do research on the person to learn additional points of common ground before you meet with them. Again, we are not trying to be manipulative. We're trying to avoid major rapport mistakes by knowing who you are talking to. My personal assistant will have a bio on you on my desk before we talk on the phone or have a meeting. We do that so that I do not say something offensive or stupid not knowing any better. Do a little simple research and find out who you are meeting with before you enter a meeting. To build trust, find places where you have common ground. It might be the car they drive, where their kids are in school, that they like to fish, or a myriad of other things that allow some connectivity and remove awkwardness in the first moments of conversation. Removal of awkwardness is called building rapport. Sell to their personality style, not with yours. Rapport is connectivity and trust. We all tend to trust people and connect to people who understand how we tick. People with relational intelligence attempt to learn how other people process information and make decisions. They will use their observations to meet people where they are and walk with them. That is called playing well with others. If you have a person like me who is hard charging, makes decisions easily, and hates details, then for goodness sakes, don't try to sell me using a 300-page research paper. You better have a 1-page summary on top of that report. I don't care if you like details. I don't. And if your personality style is all about details, you can lose the sale by losing rapport instantly with your 300-page research paper. If I am trying to build rapport with you, and you are the S, steady personality, who loves people, hates conflict, and is slow to make decisions, I should slow my hard-charging self down. My wife is that style, so I've learned to slow down and allow her to process decisions and make sure all the people involved are okay with the decision. This drives me crazy, but building rapport with my wife is not about me. It is about her. Our web team and IT team are full of detail guys, and they hate seeing a software or hardware salesperson who doesn't know every detail. That person may be selling the best product in the land, but if they don't build a rapport by figuring out the style of the buyer, they miss the sale. Figure out the style of the person you are selling to and make sure you meet them where they are. People will not buy from you if they don't trust you, your product, and your company. They will not trust you if they don't have a rapport with you. Don't try to skip this step in your sales process, or you will make a mess in the marketplace. Offer education and information. Serve, don't sell. When someone thinks of themselves as a salesperson, they immediately seem pushy. Just like real leaders aren't pushy, they instead pull. A great salesperson pulls someone, serves someone through the process rather than pushes. There is a gentleness while being proactive in this approach. As a young salesperson, I always thought of myself as the hammer and the client as the nail. I wouldn't want to be treated that way. It is a poor approach. How do you serve someone properly? By assisting them in doing business with you. Think of a great waiter, a server, and how they approach selling you dinner. They can assume you're qualified since you sat down in a restaurant, and they build rapport by smiling and introducing themselves with, "My name is John, and I will be your server." Wouldn't you feel differently on a car lot or in a clothing store if your first contact had that spirit? Our pretend waiter has now gone through the first two buying steps with you and proceeds to the third, education and information. Our waiter can explain questions we have about the menu, inform us of the daily special, tell us what he has actually eaten from the menu that he loves, or steer us away from items we might not like. He can tell us what is spicy, he can make a wine suggestion within our price range, and he can even compare some of the dishes to those of competing restaurants in the area where he has eaten. What can you learn to do with your sales process from our waiter's example? Demonstrate product knowledge. First, before you sell, serve anyone, you must know every detail and the history of your product. You cannot possibly teach someone how great something is unless you actually know it. Study your product line and know it in detail, or don't attempt to serve your customer with it. Know the menu. It is best if you can have some personal experience with the product before you serve it, sell it as well. Remember, if you are a D or an I personality that makes decisions quickly and easily, you will offend a C detail person if you don't really know your stuff. If you are a detail person, be careful to know your product intimately, because it will give you the confidence that you are truly serving the customer by assisting them in purchasing it. Be proud and passionate. Second, make sure you love and believe in your product and your company. Please don't sell Chevys when you drive a Honda. You have to believe with great integrity that the best thing from the customer's perspective is for them to do business with you. This is called integrity. Never sell something to someone that you don't believe they should buy. If you don't believe that vacuum is the best vacuum on the planet in this price range, then don't sell it. If you wouldn't want your mother to buy the item or the service, then don't sell it. As an entree leader, it is your leadership responsibility to make sure your team believes to their very core that they are serving their customer the best product at the best price. Your team and your belief in your product needs to be so deep that each person is willing to put their personal endorsement on it. Your team should act just like you do when you see a great movie and are telling your friend about it with great enthusiasm. You really think your friend is crazy if they don't go buy a ticket to that movie. Believe or don't sell. Be very proud of what you do. And if you aren't, then change it. We take this approach for selling my endorsement on our radio show to local and national sponsors. Our ad sellers are told that if you wouldn't buy it, or Dave wouldn't buy it, or Dave wouldn't want his sister buying it, then we shouldn't endorse it. So if you hear my voice promoting something, please know the company and the product or service they provide is something that passed that acid test. Know the competition. I had a wonderful experience purchasing a luxury car. I was looking at three different brands. I have owned all three at different times in my life, so I knew each one fairly well. I had studied the market and knew most of the features of the competing models. However, this particular sales guy knew every detail about every car I was considering and so served me wonderfully in my purchase. He never once used his knowledge to speak poorly of the competition. On the contrary, he told me where each model was better than the car I was considering. Wow, I found myself starting to trust this guy because he was being honest and transparent. He stood firm that his car was the car I should buy because of its particular features and quality. But he brought great information about his competition to the discussion. It was really a classy way to handle a sales role. A really sad part of my wonderful car purchase was that I was on a competitor's lot the next day, and the sales guy there knew less about the car he was selling than my guy knew about the same car. In order to serve your customer with passion, you have to know so much about the competitor that you know why you are better. You can point out the brand differentiation without trashing your competitor. I am sure you have noticed that it is hard for you to trust someone who is selling you by tearing down their competitor. Just point out the differences and why you believe you are a better choice. You cannot do that if you have not studied your competitor in detail as if you were going to sell their product. In this education step, the customer is taught about the product and how the product will serve them. In order for you to be a great teacher, you have to do more listening than talking and ask more questions as opposed to making statements. The customer will tell you what they like, what is most important to them, and will literally tell you how to serve them. We are trying to give them all the reasons they will love being our customer. When they have enough education and information to make a purchase, you don't have to hammer them. When any conversation starts, the customer sees a scale with their time and money on one side, and it is larger than the value of your good or service on the other side. People don't buy products or services. People don't buy products or services. They buy what those products or services do. You don't buy a watch. You purchase a mechanism that allows you to manage your time. If you buy an expensive watch, you purchase a mechanism that allows you to manage your time that also makes a statement about you to other people. Sell and serve by describing the benefits, not the product. What the product does is what actually matters to the customer. I need a new air conditioner because mine is broken and I want cold air blowing in my house. I like what the AC does, not what it is. I also might like the efficiency that creates lower utility bills, but I have never taken all the guys at a dinner party at my home outside to admire my really neato AC unit. All I want are the benefits. Cold air with low utilities. You must sell benefits, not products. Sell a massage because of the way the customer will feel after the massage. Sell a financial planning product because of the way the customer will feel with money to relax with at retirement and even with money to leave a legacy. No one wants to buy insurance. We buy what insurance does. So sell what it does. The closer. There is so much written and taught on closing the sale, improperly and with manipulation, that it is important to make sure you understand the entree leader closes the sale, but not with the wrong spirit or process. The garbage of poorly closing a sale I am talking about is like something I witnessed in a sales training once. The guy at the front of the room actually suggested that we fill out the contract, hold the pen above the paper, and release it in front of the client so that the client would catch the dropping pen. He suggested that since the client now had the pen in his hand, he would sign the agreement. You might get some spineless customers to respond that way, but you won't win customers for life with that kind of trash. it can't be said often enough that a properly executed sale will naturally close if you have prepared the first three steps thoroughly. You don't want to use techniques as arm twisters to push people into a pressurized sale. The customer an entree leader serves becomes a customer for life, and that doesn't happen by pushing, only by pulling, only by serving. However, with the serving spirit, the sale still must be closed. The order must be finalized. You don't stay in business if you don't collect the check. Learning to finalize the order in keeping with a serving spirit means that you need to look at some of the standard closing techniques to allow you or your team to close smoothly and with class. Feel, felt, found. Some simple little rules will help you and your team put a bow on the package and finish the order. The most basic techniques are the best because they are real. They are not manipulative. The feel, felt, found verbiage can help you pull someone over the apex of frustration. This verbal process is simply a method of reassuring a hesitant customer that they are doing the right thing. It might sound like this: John, I understand how you feel about this purchase, and I have had many clients who felt the same way. What they found was, after they became clients, they were glad they did. Let's try it again. John, I understand how you feel about taking your wife to a chick flick. I know several guys who felt the same way. They would rather see a movie that has things being blown up. But what they found was that their wife didn't like those movies, and so it defeated the purpose of a date night. Remember, everyone is in sales. The assumptive close. The assumptive close technique is what the entree leader and his team use most of the time. You are simply filling out the paperwork, gathering the information needed for shipping, etc., and assuming the prospect is going to become a customer. You simply take the order. A waitress uses the assumptive close and doesn't even know she does. Just take the order. If the prospect isn't ready to buy, they will tell you, and you will retrace the other three steps. It is interesting to remember when you are ready to order your food in a restaurant, if the marketing representative, the waitress, isn't there to take your order, you feel underserved. So closing the sale truly is serving. Most of your sales should be closed with the assumptive close. Just take the order. Serve the customer. Shut up. When you give someone a title that involves marketing or sales, they immediately get a disease that causes them to talk too much. Teach your team to ask questions and shut up. More sales are lost by yakking salespeople than will ever be gained by them yakking some brilliant statement. Ask a question that implies the purchase is going forward and shut up. You should shut up after you ask the questions for two reasons. One, it is good manners in conversation to ask a question, then wait on the response, even if there is a pregnant pause. If you will be quiet and listen, the prospect will tell you how to sell. Serve them. Proverbs says, in the multitude of words, sin is not lacking. Even a fish can't be caught if he keeps his mouth shut. The second reason to be quiet after asking a question is there is a natural pressure that builds with the pregnant pause. This is the exact moment in the transaction that the sale is made, the moment we roll down the other side of the apex of frustration. The reason the pause is called pregnant is because it gives birth. The pause, the moment of silence, literally gives birth to the sale. Be quiet. A baby sale is coming into the world. The alternative close. The alternative close is a brother of the assumptive close. During the first three steps of the buying process, you discover what the customer's needs are and are able to narrow the selection down to two possible options. The alternative close presents the two options to the customer, and both options involve buying. This close might sound like, did you want to purchase one item or get all five to get the quantity discount? Either alternative involves the prospect becoming a client. The obvious point is that a yes or no question was not presented. Do you want to buy this home? Is by definition in this discussion a stupid question. The calendar close. The calendar close is a combination of the assumptive close and the alternative close done by using the calendar. You simply present 2 days or dates that you might do business. It might sound like this. We have 2 days open for marriage counseling the week of October 16th, a Thursday and a Tuesday. Which will be better for you? Tuesday. Great. We have a 10 a.m. slot and a 2 p.m. slot open. Which is better? Great. We'll see you then. The integrity close. The integrity close is sometimes known as the puppy dog close or the test drive. You let the prospect experience the product or service in hopes or with the promise that if pleased, they will do business with you. It is really hard to take a new car home overnight, let your kids and neighbors ride in it, and then take it back the next day. In the old days, the pet shop owner would let you take the puppy home to test drive it. Almost no one can bring a puppy back. Money in the house. Regardless of the close, no sale has occurred until there is money in the house. Invoices are promises, not money. We don't pay commissions or count the sale until the money is collected. And we are hardcore about it. Do not count the sale until you have the money. Conclusion. An entree leader makes sure he loves his product and loves his customer and wants to see them married. Doing so removes the frenetic attention to the transaction just for the sake of money. And the entree leader sees business as more relational than transactional. We serve. We don't sell. But in order to serve well, we have to be intelligent and intentional about the process that humans go through in order to buy. So whether you're trying to get a date, persuade your children to get good grades, or do a business deal for money, approach the process with the good of the other person in mind. When you use that approach, you will become a servant seller and will get customers for life. Financial peace for business. Bulletproof principles for money, debt, and funding your future. In the fall of 2008, the stock market was in a free fall and there was panic in the land. There has been and will be a lot of discussions about why our economy appeared to walk to the edge of a cliff and contemplate suicide. But most of us believe the crack in the foundation was the subprime real estate debacle. Broke people were sold crummy high-interest mortgages with bad terms by greedy bankers. Stupid politicians in both parties had encouraged government-backed mortgage lenders to accept the bad deal as if it were a good deal. So a formerly reasonably run mortgage industry cracked open and fell in on itself when broke people couldn't pay their bills, which should not have surprised anyone. The crash in the fall of 2008 was more complicated than that, but when fear left Wall Street, by the time it reached Washington, D.C., it was panic. When the so-called leaders of our nation in both parties panicked, the panic left D.C., and by the time it arrived in the national media, it was full-on hysteria. Fear, panic, and even hysteria about the future of our great economy was on the news every night. As one of the loudest voices regarding money in America, I found myself on every major news outlet hour after hour giving advice and trying to spread some calm. I finished doing 3 shows on Fox News in one day and went out to eat that evening at a great New York steakhouse. As I sat there with my wife and my friends discussing the news of the day, I had a strange moment of clarity. People supposedly smarter and more sophisticated than me were literally panicking. The thought among formerly sane people was that if Congress didn't pass a huge trillion-dollar bailout, our economy would crash and life as we know it would cease on the planet. Emotions were way out of control. I have a very learned friend with a Ph.D. in economics from Stanford and an undergrad degree from Yale who says you should never make big decisions when afraid or drunk. It seemed in the fall of 2008, the vast majority of people were drunk on fear. My moment of clarity came when I struggled to figure out why I wasn't panicking. Why was I not afraid? Was I just not smart enough to really grasp the implications? I began to doubt my own intellect and beliefs for a few moments, and then it struck me. I was not afraid because I run my life and my business by common sense, biblical, financial principles, and I was not vulnerable to the mess that seemed to be looming. I had peace in the midst of the storm because I was like the little pig who built his house of brick, not hay or sticks. I had peace in the fall of 2008 while standing in the midst of people who were freaking out because from the first day of operation, we have followed the money principles in this chapter. We were sitting with lots of cash, no debt personally or in the business, with great margins on products and a spirit of generosity. This ultra-strong financial condition allowed us to grow and make investments as others were shrinking. We invested in people by hiring talent that was now on the street. We bought things that were on sale for the first time in years, like real estate, and we invested heavily in the stock market. Warren Buffett says, "Be cautious when others are greedy, and greedy, in a good way, when others are cautious. Buy stuff when it is on sale." But remember, you can't buy things on sale if you are one of the broke ones selling stuff. I can show you how to make your business prosper in great times and in the midst of storms. I can show you how to follow some time-proven financial principles that will help you remove the primary area of stress from your business. The problem is, these principles are the opposite of what most people believe and do. Most people are stressed out, freaked out people who are out of business or wish they were. So be prepared to enter the never be normal again zone. Basic principles work. Academics in the world of finance have a certain arrogance about themselves. Those of us who have been formally trained in finance have a spirit of disdain for the simple. We have been taught that simple is primitive and unsophisticated. In practice, I have to be willing to look at complicated financial options and also learn deep respect for the simple. Some of the most profound truths in any field of study are simple, yet deeply profound. The principle and the practical application of said principle does not have to be complicated to be correct. The more education you have, the more careful you should be as you listen to this chapter. You could be so smart that you miss the opportunity to be wise. I have fallen prey to that disease, and it has cost me dearly. So I recommend giving these ideas a fair hearing. Do the accounting. Most small businesses fail because of poor accounting. They start without enough money, undercapitalized. They miss projections, and they don't pay their quarterly taxes or their payroll taxes, and they run into cash flow problems. All of these so-called problems are really symptoms of not doing the accounting required to run a business. Proverbs 27:23 says, "Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and herds." At night, as the flock beds down, the shepherd counts the flock to make sure he hasn't left someone behind. He counts, does an accounting. That is all you have to do in business. But you have to do it. But we do need to look at some basics. Microbusinesses. Startup home-based businesses often forget to even do the most basic and primitive proper accounting. These businesses are often the hobby that ate the garage, or the part-time income source that took over the living room. When you are at that stage, you can unknowingly commingle, mix your money, effectively embezzling from yourself. Your first accounting step should be to open a separate checking account for the business. You don't have to incorporate or get a tax ID number to do this. You can open a simple sole proprietorship account in the DBA, doing business as, form using your Social Security number. Your little checking account can read Sally Jones, DBA, doing business as, Sally's Crafts. You don't even need to purchase those big expensive business checks. You can use a simple little checkbook, like what's used for a personal checking account. Then you should deposit every single dime of business income into that account. Never pay any business expenses except from this account, and only pay business expenses from this account. In other words, don't use your personal finances to pay business expenses, and don't use your business account to pay personal expenses. Income in and expenses out makes your checkbook register a simple profit and loss statement for cash basis accounting. This simply means the checkbook balance is your profit. No cheating allowed. Run this accounting like it was someone else's business. You would never steal from them or pay their bills from your personal account. This simple step will show you if you are profitable, if you are winning. Taxes will kill your business. I hate taxes, but I hate unpaid, unfunded taxes even more. If you don't keep up with your taxes, that alone will close you down. If you are in a product business where you collect and deposit sales taxes and you borrow that sales tax money to operate, you will fail. If you have employees and don't deposit the proper amount withheld from them for taxes, you will fail. These simple ideas about staying ahead of the tax man are backbreaking for those who don't follow them. When you take some of your profit from your separate business checking account and bring it home, you should set aside 25% in a savings account so you can pay your quarterly estimates as required by the IRS. So open a tax savings account that you deposit money in every time you write yourself a check from your business account. I started my business all those years ago doing this very basic step, and I have never had the tax man after me. For example, if you are going to pull $2,000 from your business checking account, you would write yourself a personal check for $1,500 and another check for $500 to deposit in your tax savings account. You are withholding taxes on yourself at a very basic level, but you must start here. Budget. Almost all small businesses will have their tax preparer or CPA prepare a profit and loss P&L statement at the end of the year for tax purposes. If you do a slightly better job, you get a monthly P&L or even do your own. The profit and loss statement tells you what happened last month, last quarter, or last year. It does not tell you what is going to happen. You should do the P&L, but you must also do more. The P&L is like driving your car using only the rearview mirror. However, the very first accounting you should do is a budget, which is like driving while looking out the windshield, looking forward. Doing a budget will make the obvious become a reality and force you to prepare and think of options. If you have a landscape business, budgeting and thereby projecting income will force you to recognize that winter is going to be slow. And like the squirrel, you should put some nuts in the nest. All I am asking is that you be as smart as a squirrel. That is a fairly low bar, the squirrel bar. Act your wage. Once a business person starts to make some money, they tend to get really sloppy. Just like we do at home, businesses overspend on lifestyle items, but their rationalization is much more sophisticated. They can rationalize all kinds of toys and equipment they don't really need, all in the name of adding credibility or supposed increased productivity. The most profitable businesses and the most stable businesses are those that have avoided the need for toys or the emotional need to impress visitors. Get some nice things and toys, but only with surplus money and never with the rationalization that they are actually needed to conduct business. I visited a billionaire's business to do a multi-million dollar transaction. In his lobby was a couch that the Naga hide had been stripped from so long ago, the couch was shedding. When we sat down to have our big meeting, we sat around a folding table on stacking chairs. He had no need to impress me with his furniture, since he knew it was access to his business I wanted. If you and your business are attractive, you don't have to impress anyone with your furniture or toys. No deal was ever made or lost based on the couch in the reception area. That is ego. Tax savings rationalization. The wise entree leader never rationalizes a tax savings on unnecessary purchases in order to make a profit. If you need something to make a profit and want to buy it and pay for it a few months early to throw the expense in one tax year versus another, that is wise. But making not needed purchases and then strutting around like a peacock in your new Hummer, saying stupid phrases like, my CPA told me I needed to spend some money to save on taxes, is stupid and will set you up to fail. Yes, you should always take appropriate deductions for expenses associated with the proper operation of your business. However, if your CPA says you should spend money you don't need to spend buying items not needed for the business to, quote, save on taxes, you should fire your CPA because they can't add. Do the math. If you are making $75,000 per year, you are in a 25% tax bracket. If you spend $10,000 that you didn't need to spend solely to save on taxes, you create a $10,000 tax deduction. A $10,000 tax deduction saves you 25% or $2,500. So the tax savings rationalization has you spending $10,000 you didn't need to spend in order to save $2,500 in taxes. If you think that is good math, you will definitely fail at business. Debt. If you have been in business very long, you will soon realize that we make mistakes. We all make mistakes and have some really dumb ideas. Most of us have an idea a day, and most of those ideas stink. After being in business several decades and achieving national prominence with the Dave Ramsey brand, I am convinced that our company makes almost all of our revenue and enjoys all of our success on about 10% of our ideas. We survive the other 90% of our ideas. Maybe the percentages are wrong, but those of us who have been around a while can testify that most of our ideas, brainstorms, and revelations prove to be stupid, or at least wrong. Debt magnifies mistakes. Since I don't know which one of my brilliant ideas is going to be a mistake, it becomes a huge error to borrow into and increase the size of my mistake. We have made so many errors and miscalculations, there aren't enough pages to recount them. I am sure our gleaming mountain of success is actually a pile of garbage, a pile of mistakes and missteps. Only we are standing on it rather than lying buried under it. If you are standing on mistakes, you are a success. However, if you have borrowed to increase the size of your mistakes, you will be out of business. Non-fatal failure is encouraged and is how you learn to ride a bike. But when you borrow to implement your latest brilliant plan, you exponentially increase your chances of fatal failure. Space Camp. We have a wonderful series of children's storybooks that teach financial principles to children ages 3 to 12. They are world-class stories illustrated by my cousin, Marshall Ramsey, who is an editorial cartoonist and has been twice nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. When we started, we originally had 4 books in which our character, Junior, Financial Peace Junior, went on 4 adventures where he learned to work, save, spend, and give. Our friends at Chick-fil-A asked us if they could license 5 children's books to put in their kids' meals. Their plan was to put 1 book per week in the meals for 5 weeks, about 2.5 million books total. License fees for opportunities like this are not much, so we wanted to come up with an idea to make some money off this fabulous exposure and brand lift. Since we had 4 books, and they needed 5, our plan was to create 3 more books. With 3 more, we could provide 5 books to Chick-fil-A and have 2 more to advertise on the back of all 2.5 million. Our plan, of course, was that we would sell several gift boxes of all 7 books in hardback, or at least sell the 2 extra books they didn't get in the meals. So Junior went on 3 more adventures, where he learned about debt, integrity, and contentment. The new book on contentment was called Adventures in Space. In this book, Junior wants to attend space camp and isn't able to attend because it's so expensive and his parents are on a budget. Junior is very sad, but his dad goes to the big box store and gets some leftover boxes to build a spaceship. Junior and some of his other friends who couldn't afford the expensive space camp have a blast playing in the boxes. Junior's friends, who attended the big, nice, expensive space camp, got rained on all week and didn't have fun at all. So Junior learned the wonderful lesson of contentment. What a wonderful, inspiring story until the director of the real space camp from the Huntsville Space and Rocket Center called to ask why we were stealing their federally trademarked term, space camp. He was nice, but then their attorney started sending us threatening letters. We were stupid. We were wrong. We had completely violated their trademark accidentally. I own many trademarks and copyrights and would never steal from someone. We had no idea Space Camp was trademarked. The story gets worse. Apparently, the director of the real Space Camp's wife listens to me on the radio and respects our mission. So when she discovered that Dave Ramsey said that Space Camp was bad and too expensive, she confronted her husband about why he would do such a thing. Ouch! We were completely in the wrong, even if it was by accident. They could have taken huge chunks out of us, and it appeared their attorney was suggesting they do so. I personally called the director and profusely apologized and offered to personally tell his wife this was a huge mistake. He was understandably upset. But the more we talked, the more he realized I was not a crook, though possibly me and my company could be accused of stupidity. He graciously allowed us to certify that our remaining stock of Space Camp books had been shredded. And now any of his team is allowed to attend our events free forever. Oh, brother. We were so excited about this project that had we been willing to borrow, we would have shredded 250,000 books. But since we don't borrow, we don't magnify our mistakes. We only had to shred about 22,000 books, which we were happy to do to avoid any further theft on our part. Actually, we weren't happy about losing the money, but it was the right thing to do and a gracious settlement offer on the part of the real Space Camp. For the record, the real Space Camp, which I didn't previously know existed, is a fine camp and is not expensive for what you receive, and they didn't have to threaten me to get me to say that. Debt kills cash. When small businesses fail, it is usually blamed on cash flow. As I have said, this cash flow problem can actually be translated as tax problems and debt problems. If a business has no debt, by definition, they have more cash than a competitor running the same business model down the street in debt. The dry cleaner who has $300,000 borrowed on an SBA loan and a second mortgage on his home is more likely to fail than the dry cleaner who is debt-free. So debt is a destabilizing force that exponentially increases risk and the probability of fatal failure. Companies that carry debt and are publicly traded are devalued in the marketplace due to their increased risk. Even an undergraduate investment finance class teaches this basic principle of finance. Yet supposedly sophisticated and educated people spend an inordinate amount of energy trying to say debt is good when used properly. Debt is needed to open and operate a business, they say. The reality is there are many, many debt-free companies that are small businesses that last generations. Even among the large companies, there are many that are debt-free because they don't want the risk or the drain on cash. All these debt-free companies seem to fly under the radar of what the culture has come to believe, that debt is most often used in business to win, which turns out to be a false belief. Large debt-free companies you may have heard of include Cisco, Microsoft, Chick-fil-A, Hobby Lobby, Bed Bath & Beyond, The Gap, Electronic Arts, EA Games, eBay, Apple, Google, and Wrigley. Peter Andrew, a former analyst with A.G. Edwards, says, "What kills companies is debt. Without debt, companies have the wherewithal to survive." Debt mythology. There are several myths about debt that float around in the air and in conversation about business that need to be addressed. The first one says you can't start or expand a business without debt. The reality is most people do not start their business, nor do they need to, with a huge loan, a huge amount of brand new equipment, and a building with a mortgage.